Hello, and welcome to Safari Conversations, the Singita podcast. Even though we've been around for 30 years, we're relatively new to podcasting. But we are storytellers by nature, and we've got so much to share with you. Alongside our conservation partners, we've been busy exploring and protecting Africa's wilderness. So join us as we unpack inspiring, fun, and sometimes crazy stories where you'll meet our incredible people and learn all about the special places in Africa that we call home. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes.
My name is Ben Nicol. I am the Conservation Impact Lead for the Singita Lofot Trust, or SLT for short, and I'm based at Singita's Sabi Sand property. For those who don't know, the SLT is Singita's non-profit conservation and community development partner. We operate in the Greater Kruger National Park region of South Africa, and today I'm joined by Dr. Gareth Tait. Gareth is the Birds of Prey Program Manager for the Endangered Wildlife Trust, or EWT for short. He is here to chat a bit about vulture conservation. Gareth, welcome to Safari Conversations.
Thanks, Ben. Thanks for having me.
Now, Gareth, we've met before and know each other, but for those who don't know, Gareth is quite tough to pin down, so it's a real privilege to have him on the show today. Gareth, could you tell us a bit about yourself? What drew you into the world of conservation, and how did you end up focusing on raptors in particular?
Yeah, thanks, Ben. It's always a good question to ask. And from a young age, I've always been captivated by the wonders of the natural world and always drawn to everything that is wild and wonderful. I think it's something that you and I can really relate to. And growing up in the Lowveld of South Africa, my fascination really evolved into kind of a deep passion for understanding, you know, the web of diversity that thrives in this region. And this curiosity really drove me to immerse myself in learning about the complex roles that each species plays in the ecosystem. And as I advanced through my undergraduate and postgraduate studies, my passion for biodiversity as a whole grew. And this kind of grew alongside a profound realization that the natural world that you and I cherish is under severe threat. And this awareness really ignited kind of a personal mission within me to really dedicate my career to the protection and conservation of wildlife. And among all these incredible species, you know, raptors have always played a special role in my life and has a special place in my heart. And they really do symbolize, you know, the very essence of wild places that they inhabit. And I think it's kind of the extraordinary and often elusive lifestyles and their role as kind of apex predators and the intricate behaviors, you know, how they forage and how they raise their young and the battles they go through. These kind of things have always fascinated me. And more than just kind of remarkable creatures, they're also powerful kind of indicators or barometers of ecosystem health. So protecting these birds also means safeguarding, you know, habitats and a myriad of other species that depend on these habitats.
I think we're so lucky, honestly, to have you in this conservation space, but particularly working on raptors, you know, which are such, as you say, important species of biodiversity importance. It's, yeah, wonderful. So thanks for all your work. I feel that vultures often, we're going to talk about vultures in particular, but vultures often get a bad rap as nature's creepy cleanup crew, or even the grim reapers of the bush. They really have quite a different appearance, but I know there's a lot more to them than meets the eye. Could you maybe take us through what makes vultures stand out and why are they a species of such ecosystem and conservation importance?
Yeah, you mentioned bad rap, and I always think about, you know, Disney's Jungle Boy. I think it was Disney's Jungle Boy, and how the vultures, the characters always used to give me nightmares. But certainly, you know, vultures have this bad rap, but they don't deserve it. And the more we work on them, the more we realize just how fascinating and how important they are within the landscapes that they inhabit. And there's no scavenger out there that can kind of perform this scavenging role as well as a vulture. They travel massive distances and they're often very gregarious and feed in large groups. The ecosystem service that they perform is just kind of unmatched. And you know, with this, they really provide a really important ecosystem service by cleaning up carcasses and removing waste out of the ecosystem. So they are in fact nature's cleanup crew. And with this, they reduce the spread of diseases and they really have an important role. And if you remove vultures from the landscape, you very readily and immediately feel the impacts of not having that ecosystem service present anymore. And we've seen this kind of echoed through the Asian vulture crisis, where India lost almost 98% of their vultures. They almost faced the immediate impacts of spreading of diseases like rabies, for instance, which cost the government millions of dollars to control. And a lot of work was put into recover those vulture populations and restore this ecosystem service that is so beneficial to humans and a lot of the species and habitats around them.
Yeah, they really are critical species to our environment. You talk about the Indian vulture crisis. I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, across the globe, there's about 23 different living species of vultures. And so therefore quite a diverse group as far as birds go. And I believe that about 11 of those vulture species sort of migrate in and out of Africa or are residents to the continent itself. And some of our listeners might even be lucky enough to spot them while out on safari. Could you possibly take us through some of our African vulture species and how they're special in their own right? I believe the EWT has a focus group of about 7. Maybe you could talk to those in particular.
Yeah, so 11 species across Africa, but we have 7 more kind of resident species here in South Africa. And a lot of our work is obviously focused on these breeding residents. So we get kind of 2 types of vultures that we have here in South Africa, the tree nesting species, which are often associated with kind of the more savanna landscapes. These are your white back, white headed, your lappet face and hooded vultures. And then we have our cliff nesters, which are, you know, special in their own way, but we have our cape vultures and our bearded vultures, which are more kind of associated with our more mountainous landscapes. Yeah. And they, you know, they all are very different in their own way. We have species that appear a lot more common within our region. So white back vultures, if you're lucky enough to travel through the Kruger National Park, for instance, you'll see they're the more common species you see. They're the more gregarious species, often arriving at a carcass in large numbers, sometimes over 100. And what's amazing is they can clean up a carcass, you know, the size of an impala, which is about 40 kilograms, in under 10 minutes. And you know, we talk about that ecosystem service, but it really is remarkable how they remove waste from the landscape. So, yeah, as mentioned, we focus on about 7 species here in South Africa. And, you know, just watching them over the last few years of my conservation career, you just need to sit and watch these vultures interact with the carcass to see how different they really are and the specific roles they play in the scavenging process. And it might seem like a bit of chaos at a carcass when you watch them, but there certainly is kind of a pecking order and a hierarchy that you can pick up when watching these birds closely. There's a lot of socializing and a lot of kind of interactions on these carcasses. And if you look closely at the size differences between our species and the more kind of elaborate designs of their heads and their beaks, it really is phenomenal how, you know, they perform different roles. As I mentioned, you've got the white backs that come in big numbers and they clean up the carcasses and focus on things like the fleshy bits and the guts. But then you've got your lappets, which have a completely different role, and they arrive and they often feed on the tendons and the bones and tougher bits of a carcass, so they're not going for the same kind of bit on a carcass. And then you've got your beautiful little hooded vultures that kind of sit on the side and watch all this chaos and often get pieces of flesh getting thrown around. The hooded vultures are on the edge, always picking at these scraps, but then they hang around long after all the other vultures are gone. And their beak design, this beautiful slender bill, is designed to kind of clean up the bits of flesh between the ribs and the spine. And so you can see they all have these different roles, but are very, you know, highly adapted to these different roles. And for me, it's really interesting. And don't forget how much socializing is happening around these carcasses. Often you'll see a breeding pair of lappets or white-headed vultures, which are really beautiful, probably our most beautiful vulture, but they land and they almost kind of bully other vultures away. And they have these kind of courtship behavior around these carcasses, which is really fascinating to me. And I think if people just give it a bit of time and sit and watch these birds, I think they'll also start enjoying them and loving them.
No, it really is quite incredible. You know, anyone who's had the privilege of seeing vultures descend on a carcass, it's absolutely unbelievable to see how that thing just disappears in a matter of minutes, in all honesty. You know, as you say, something like an impala, just, it's like it was never there. So truly incredible. You alluded to it a bit earlier that there's quite a big sort of crisis going on over in India, but us in Africa, our vultures are also exposed to a wide variety of threats. I mean, most of the species that you've just mentioned, they are now classified anywhere from vulnerable to critically endangered. And as you just said, you know, people like yourself are calling this a legitimate crisis. Could you maybe tell us what's driving the African vulture crisis? What are the biggest threats to these birds, and why should we all be paying attention?
Absolutely. So we certainly are in the experiencing an African vulture crisis, and many of our species have experienced rapid population declines over the last 20 years or so. And as you mentioned, we've seen populations, for instance, white-back vultures that have declined by 95% over the last two decades. And a lot of people don't know this. I mean, they are our most common vulture species. And if you look up into the sky or visit a carcass in the Kruger, and I use the Kruger a lot because that's where we do a lot of our work, you'll think that they're doing fine, but their numbers are certainly declining. And in 2017, five of our vulture species, their conservation status was basically uplisted. And now we're sitting with several species that are, you know, shifting rapidly towards extinction and are now classified as either endangered or critically endangered globally. And, you know, there's a variety of drivers and threats behind their decline, but by far the biggest threat to vultures is poisoning. And this might be either direct or indirect poisoning. So vultures are often the unintended victims to poisons left out for other animals. So often what we're seeing is that poisons are put out for a predator, and the vultures will come and feed on that poison source that's left out for that predator, and they obviously succumb to the poisons. But they also are targeted for their body parts. So for the traditional medicinal trade, there is a high demand for vulture body parts, in particular parts of their body like their brain are taken and you know, used as traditional medicine and prescribed for different purposes. I won't get into too much detail around that, but what we're seeing is that vultures are heavily targeted using poisons for traditional medicine and belief-based medicinal practices. There's also a big issue with a form of poisoning called sentinel poisoning. So vultures are often just through their natural foraging and they're kind of circling around and descending down into a carcass can often give away the presence of a carcass. And if that animal has been poached for its ivory or horns, often, you know, we have response teams and anti-poaching units following vultures and locating these carcasses. And so what poachers are doing is trying to remove these sentinels from the landscape, and they systematically sterilizing ecosystems of their vultures through sentinel poisoning. So they will effectively kill, you know, between 50 and 100 birds on one single poisoning event. And that's driven massive declines across Africa. So poisoning for sure is the biggest driver. And in fact, over the last couple of decades, about 96% of vulture mortalities have been linked with some form of poisoning. So it's something that we're working hard to address. Obviously, habitat loss is a big issue. We're seeing a lot of issues around the loss of vultures on energy infrastructure. So birds often collide with power lines. They're not designed the way their visual field of view and the way they fly. They're not designed to see a line in their way. So they often collide with power lines. And more recently, we've also found that they are quite susceptible and vulnerable to colliding with wind turbines. So wind turbines are actually killing a lot of birds in areas where there's an overlap between, you know, renewable energy and their ranges. And then electrocutions on power lines is also a massive issue. We're losing hundreds of birds a year on power lines. So it's also something that we're trying to address quite proactively and reactively. And we have various kind of conservation projects with a lot of partners working on the ground to address this issue. Yeah, so those are the kind of main things I think we focus on. Poisoning is by far the biggest thing that we're trying to address.
You know, just on that, Gareth, I think I find that poisoning, it's obviously incredibly sad, but it's also very fascinating. I don't know if, I mean, you must have come across a couple poisoning events in your career. I mean, what is the scale of it? I mean, have you seen a serious poisoning event? And is it, it must be something quite unbelievable. Could you maybe just tell us a bit about something like that?
Yeah, I mean, the loss of wildlife at these poisoning events is just, it takes your breath away, and I don't think anyone will ever get used to it. You know, we've seen in the last couple of years, and I would say over the last 2 years in particular, we've seen more targeted poisonings designed for lions, and we've seen there's obviously a growing demand for lion body parts both locally and internationally. And with this, you know, poisons are left out for lions, and, you know, a handful of our more recent poisonings have been associated with targeted lion poisoning. And on these events, you know, you can find between 50 and 100 vultures. I think in our last mass poisoning, we lost 108 vultures, but it's not only your vultures that you lose. We also seeing a lot of other scavenging raptors. So we've seen bataleers and tawny eagles, often victims to poisons left out for other animals. So it's just something that really, it really is devastating. And it's a really ominous kind of threat that we're dealing with. I think it's a good example to use as probably one of the biggest poisonings that I've not personally come across, but our partners have come across, as a poisoning up in northern Botswana where an elephant was poached and then laced with poisons, and that killed over 500 vultures. So you can imagine in an area where you have declining vulture populations, they take a long time to recover from that. You know, in the greater Kruger region, we've seen, I would say, probably a 90% loss in the birds in that landscape. So it really is devastating, and something that we are very committed to turning around.
I suppose that's what's the light at the end of the tunnel here, is just your guys' work. But it is, it's unbelievable to hear about the scale of the threat that our vultures face. I've actually learned from you, I heard it before, but you really brought it to my attention that vultures need a massive area to thrive. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I read somewhere that vultures, white-back vultures in particular, can fly anywhere up to 200 kilometers in a day, and some even cover over 1,000 kilometers in a week. How do you go about conserving a species that needs such vast areas to exist? And what are some of the biggest challenges when it comes to protecting them?
Certainly the biggest challenge you've already kind of underpinned, and that is just the vast areas that these birds need to thrive. And the more we work on them, the more we understand how big this area is. They certainly have core areas that they have a higher fidelity to, where they breed and where they feed more. We've been working on extensive tracking projects, and we now currently have about 400 vultures fitted with these high resolution tracking units. And you get to see how much distance these birds cover in a single day. And as you mentioned, it's, you know, in excess of 150 kilometers a day. And some of these birds are moving in home ranges over 100,000 square kilometers. So they really are huge landscapes. I think, about five times the size of the Kruger National Park. And to conserve them is extremely challenging. So, you know, we have to have these really holistic, wide-ranging approaches. And a lot of this has been brought together through our multi-species action plan for the conservation of vultures. And this is basically the Bible of vulture conservation. And that pulls together partners from across vulture range states, so across Africa through Eurasia. And it's a really important way to make sure that there's collaboration and partnerships happening across these range states that these birds move across. So I think that is really an important product that has been published for us to guide our vulture conservation and identify the critical actions for vulture conservation. So that document has been incredibly useful. But yeah, we obviously have to adapt our conservation approaches to the landscape we're working in. And as you move across landscapes, it's highly dynamic. So the threats change across. You can imagine as you move across from the Karoo of South Africa into kind of the more eastern parts where we have a lot more protected areas, your threats are very dynamic and they change. So we have to adapt to that, and we also have to protect, you know, areas that are most important to vultures. So one of the conservation approaches that we've been applying is the establishment of vulture safe zones. And don't let the name misguide you, because it's almost impossible to create a 100% safe space for vultures, especially ones that need big areas. But what these safe zones do is that they actively reduce threats within large landscapes, and particularly these areas where vultures spend more time. So we've worked a lot to identify these areas where they breed and where they forage, and then actively working with massive networks of landowners to remove these threats to vultures and protect these core ranges and reduce mortalities within these ranges. So I think that's been a really successful project of ours. We now have almost a million hectares of land committed to the establishment of vulture safe zones. So we're working with, as I mentioned, just huge networks of people, and at the grassroots of most of these projects are the landowners themselves. And with these landowners, we've identified and, you know, formed relationships to start removing threats one by one off their properties. And that's been really phenomenal. In terms of poisoning, as I mentioned, it is certainly at the heart of our work and at the center of our focus. And a lot of our work is largely reactive in nature. We do a lot of work to respond to poisoning events, and we're applying a lot of really cool technology to address wildlife poisoning. We've turned to tracking technology. As I mentioned, we've tracked almost 400 birds from South Africa all the way up to South Sudan and Chad, covering massive areas. And we monitor these birds in near real time. And on a daily basis, our teams are watching these birds, which are also providing us alerts to when they feed and when they encounter poisons in the landscape. And what we can do is respond immediately when a bird provides us with an immobility alert associated with a poisoning event. We can send teams in there to save surviving wildlife. In the last year alone, we've saved over 100 vultures that would have succumbed to those poisons left out in the landscape. And then also finding poisoning events early enables us to decontaminate the scene and then prevent mass fatalities on these poisonings. And we talk a lot about vultures, but also bear in mind that by decontaminating these scenes and finding them really quickly, we also prevent the loss of other scavengers. And we're talking lions, hyenas, leopards, jackal, the whole suite of scavengers that are also being hit hard by poisoning. Yeah, and we're also excited. You know, we built the very first vulture ambulance, which is deployed in the Greater Kruger. And this ambulance has been a really important tool for us to respond to poisonings. It's basically like a mobile clinic, and we can treat surviving vultures on these poisoning events immediately. And then it holds about 20 crates, so we can crate birds and we can remove them from the poisoning event, and we can start the rehab process immediately. And what's quite exciting is with our partners, like Maholoholo Rehab in the Limpopo province, we've now got almost 100% success rate, survival rate in birds that we find alive at poisoning events. So that's kind of really testament to the work that we've been developing and, you know, focusing on reducing the impact of poisoning. And then also really importantly is, you know, we've detected 36 poison sources over the last year using our system, our tracked vultures. And that's 36 mass poisonings that we've prevented. So before any major wildlife poisoning has happened at these scenes, we've decontaminated those scenes and prevented massive die-offs of animals. So I think that's a huge success metric for the work that we're doing in the Greater Kruger alone. So yeah, as you can see, there's a lot of different conservation approaches. I would say at the heart of a more successful approach is partnerships and cross-boundary partnerships. So we're working with people all over Africa with the same goal of reducing threats in the landscape and obviously curbing the impact of wildlife poisoning.
It's wonderful to hear that, you know, the measures you guys are putting in place really has made an impact. I think people often underestimate all the challenges that come with not just conserving a specific species, but also where we're based. I mean, there's quite a limited resource in Africa. So it's good to hear that there is hope for the future. You touched on how important it is to work with partners and other foundations. Ecotourism brands like Singita, along with their conservation partners like the SLT, have outspoken commitments to preserving Africa's wilderness and wildlife for future generations. And a big part of how we go about this is teaming up with organizations like the EWT. How do you personally see ecotourism contributing to the preservation of vultures and other species? And could you possibly share some insights into how the SLT in particular is supporting you over at the EWT?
Yeah, I think ecotourism, for me, the major benefits of it is it's such a good place to spread awareness about vulture conservation, the current conservation status of our vulture populations. And I think ecotourism opens up that kind of window or opportunity to engage with people that you wouldn't normally be able to engage with on a email or through a social media platform. So it's actually meeting people that are are largely passionate about wildlife and nature. So it really puts you into contact with a remarkable network of people that often end up being, you know, important donors to a lot of the work that we do. So it's kind of that exposure of our work to these individuals that they come on safaris to South Africa. And often if you think about a lot of tourists and talking also about South African tourists, they drive through a landscape and they come through the gates into the Kruger National Park and they see nature and a beautiful environment, but they don't really know what's going on behind the scenes. And I think tapping into that ecotourism sector and exposing them to the realities of poaching and poisoning and then showing them what's needed to be able to, you know, protect these landscapes, it's really, really is critical. As I mentioned, it's a really good avenue to also establish good donors and supporters of your conservation work. In terms of the Singita Lo-Fi Trust, it's been an exciting partnership and relationship that we're developing. Not only are we able to access these properties that are their custodians to really important vulture-rich landscapes, so it enables us to work within these landscapes, but also to collaborate on exciting things. So, for instance, you know, our poisoning response work is largely funded by the Singita Lo-Fi Trust, and the development and building of our vulture ambulance is also enabled by the Singita Lo-Fi Trust. So the work that they're doing to support a variety of our conservation interventions has been really phenomenal. And I think we haven't even tapped into that relationship properly yet. And I'm excited for what the future holds for this collaboration. And also, as I mentioned, just making sure that we can provide a lot of Singita's guests with deep insight into the conservation that's needed to keep these spaces wild and beautiful.
It's really awesome, Gareth. And I look forward. It was a while ago that you were here. So I'd really like you to come through, because at Ebony, we've put together our conservation room. That's Ebony Lodge in the Sabi Sand. And we've put together a conservation room that showcases a lot of the projects and all the amazing work that's being done in the area. And the EWT is up there in full colors. So I really look forward to when you come back. And I also hope that I can get an invite at some point soon to come out there and catch Marshall Eagles with you and learn a bit more about how to handle vultures. I know it's not the most glamorous job, but it's certainly something I'm super interested in. It looks like we're nearly running out of time. So I'm sure some of you listening and any future Singita guests may be wondering how you can get involved and help out. As Gareth said, donations go a long way. And if you would like to support EWT's mission to save wildlife, head over to the SLT website at www.singitalofoldtrust.org, where 100% of your donation will contribute towards support of the EWT large raptor and carnivore conservation programs in the greater Kruger region. If guests are interested in helping out and donating, Gareth, could you tell us a bit about where their funds will be going towards?
Sure, Ben. Every cent counts, obviously, and those funds are used for a variety of things. You know, keeping our staff on the ground is always really critical. We need to be present in these landscapes, and a lot of the work we do is centered on keeping staff active in the field. But the work is obviously also goes towards various aspects of our poisoning response work. So money could be used to go directly towards our vulture tracking satellite costs or satellite tracking costs. And then, you know, also the costs that are needed to keep our response teams on the ground and, you know, for our Raptor Emergency Fund, which covers a lot of things from rescue to rehabilitation efforts, vet bills, toxicology tests. A lot of these various components are quite expensive. And then responding to poisonings and also working towards reducing threats across the landscape. So those funds will also be directly channeled into basic logistics, as I mentioned, to keep our work active within the landscape.
Gareth, before we go, could you maybe tell us where you see the most hope for the future when it comes to vulture conservation?
Yeah, so it's very easy to become negative and immersed in that negativity as a vulture conservationist, looking at the challenges we're facing and the extent of the landscapes we're working in. But there is certainly light at the end of the tunnel. And I think for the first time in Africa and in South Africa, we're actually seeing a big focus channeled into vulture conservation. And we've just had our very own National Vulture Task Force formed. And along with that, we've got South Africa's first gazetted vulture biodiversity management plan. So we've got government endorsed, conservation actions that are being pushed for the country and for the vultures of this landscape. And I think people are coming together in a way that we've never before, to protect vultures. And so we are seeing, positive changes out there. And, we've had, Cape vultures, which have had a lot of work done on them over the last 25 years, being downlisted from endangered to vulnerable. So we are seeing things happen out there that are really positive, and we really do hope that we can keep vultures soaring across African skies for our kids to see. So I think there is hope at the end of the day, and that's going to come in the form of collaborations and partnerships across vulture range states, and we're really excited about that.
For more info about the Endangered Wildlife Trust in particular and the incredible work people like Gareth are doing, you can visit their website at www.ewt.org.za. Gareth, thanks so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Thanks, Ben. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you very soon and getting on the property and also getting you into the field with us.
Super, super keen. From all of us here at Singita, thanks so much for tuning in. Until next time, take it easy.
Thank you for listening. If you want to follow other episodes of our podcast series, Safari Conversations, please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from or on our website at singita.com.